Tonight is a case study in euthanasia called Witnessing to Life. This is part of a series that I'm running on various ethical issues. Tomorrow at 4 o'clock will be a discussion of a case on abortion. That case study will be available in the library, and if you know you're coming to the session tomorrow, I have some copies here I can hand out before you go if you know you're coming to the session tomorrow. This is a way, if those of you who haven't done a case with me yet, this is a way of teaching. I don't always teach by cases, but I use cases quite a bit in my own teaching and have found it an interesting and fairly dialogical way to proceed. My name is Bob Stivers. If you haven't met me or been in one of my classes in the last 2 weeks, I teach religion and ethics at Pacific Lutheran University. Now, tonight's case, Witnessing to Life, is about a young man. Well, at least he's the focus of attention in some respects, though he is not responsive. A young man who was preparing for medical school. His name is Tom Haven. And in preparation for his interest in medicine, he volunteered on an emergency squad. The ambulance was in an accident one night. He sustained severe head injuries and was in a coma, unconscious with serious brain damage. They managed to stabilize the situation, and of course, then he stayed in this comatose state, and they transferred him to a hospital, to a nursing home. The test indicated that the brain activity was minimal, though he was not brain dead. That's a technical point that's very important. The doctor in the case, Dr. Karen Cook, indicated her perspective on the ability to let go, saying that in her perspective, that the mere functioning of the body is not of ultimate significance, but rather the life of a person lived in community. She thought it was morally permissible to let someone in such a condition let go. And on the other side of it was an uncle, Uncle Bill Thompson, who indicated from a religious perspective that thou shalt not kill, that life is sacred, that one should keep Tom alive at all costs, using all kinds whatever means is necessary. Now John and Mary Haven, the parents, are caught in the squeeze. Mary has indicated her interest in preserving life. John has not indicated his perspective on it, but is severely worried about the conditions of the family and what is happening as a result of the situation. The comatose state has persisted now for over 2 years. And the children, one child is the daughter, the 15-year-old daughter, it says, has started hanging around with a different crowd, and the family finances have been pretty well wiped out. Andrew, a student who would like to go to the college in the fall, does not now have money to go to college. Insurance has been exhausted, it says. Thanksgiving comes around, and Mama suggests that they go and have Thanksgiving dinner at the nursing home, at which point the two children split and say they got other plans for Thanksgiving. Very serious situation. In December, Tom contracts pneumonia, and the issue that doctor calls and asks whether she should treat the pneumonia or not. To not treat the pneumonia would presumably lead to the young man's death in several days of that disease. To treat it would be with antibiotics would cure the disease, and the same situation would persist. The question is, should they or should they not treat the pneumonia. Okay, what is euthanasia? Who can define that word? I want to go through a few definitions first. What does the word euthanasia mean?
Mercy killing,
sort of. You know what the Greek is? It comes from the Greek?
Good death.
Yeah, you is happy, like utopia. Utopia is a happy place. That thanatos is death, so euthanasia literally is a happy death. You can mercy killing is fine. The distinctions are made, however, that perhaps are important, and that is in terms of the types of, if I can go to number three, I didn't put these in any particular order, it's often mentioned that there's active and passive euthanasia. What is active euthanasia?
To inject.
The extreme form would be to inject a lethal dose of something that would actively kill the person. Passive euthanasia, did you answer?
I did.
Oh, there you are.
Roger.
I know Roger. What's passive euthanasia then, in contrast? He's been well versed. He's been one of my students.
Yes, and I read through this story many times. To allow them to die, to withdraw help, and to allow them to die.
Just let natural causes do nothing, or do not interfere actively. The extreme of active euthanasia is what? What?
Kevorkian?
What would you call an extreme form of active euthanasia?
Well, the Kevorkian case?
You mean the one, is that the one on the VW or?
No, but where the gal had the Alzheimer's and he went back and did his Michigan.
Yeah, there's been several of these cases. Yeah. The most active, if you go in and shoot a person, it's called murder in an extreme form. The big problem with active euthanasia is at some point it borders over into murder, particularly when there's a large insurance policy or something on that order. So active euthanasia is actively ending. Passive is letting die in rough terms. Voluntary, involuntary. Voluntary is?
The subject wishes it.
Yeah, where the subject wishes it. Involuntary, where they have not indicated a choice and someone has to decide for them. What is this case in terms of active, passive, voluntary, involuntary? Now, in terms of pneumonia, it would be passive, involuntary. There's been no indication that he's left anything like a living will. By the way, I assume that there's people here who are even more expert on these issues than I am in this case, so I'm not going to parade myself off as an expert on these, and I hope that you will bring in your expertise and I invite that as we go along. One other distinction that's made in cases of this is ordinary and extraordinary means. There's no hard and fast definition of these things, but in general terms, how would you define ordinary and extraordinary means? An extreme form of extraordinary would be what? Using what?
Euthanasia, you mean?
No. What means to keep a person
alive?
Hooking them up to any means possible, no matter what cost or what the machine is or whatever the pain is to the person. And ordinary means would be providing normal sustenance. In this case, the young man is in the nursing home, is receiving intravenous feeding. His other organs besides his brain are existing apparently quite normally, it says, with youthful vigor, and the damages to his brain, which according to the doctor is considerable, and I think it said, in her opinion, though, correct me if I'm wrong, there's little chance of recovery. Okay, that's by way of setting this up, by way of definitions. We can use those terms perhaps as we go through. Let me ask, I want to start instead of on the ethical level, which is a form of rationality, I'd rather start on the feelings level. Would anyone volunteer who has been in a situation where they had to decide, is there anyone here who has been in that situation who would describe some of the feelings they had when they went through that?
My husband's mother had Alzheimer's, and when we were placing her in the nursing home, we had to decide whether or not she would be code blue or whatever, I can't remember how they classified it, but whether or not they would do something to prolong her life in case of pneumonia or something like that. I have no qualms about it because of the Alzheimer's thing. You know? Mm-hmm. And I almost felt guilty because I didn't have qualms. I almost thought I ought to be concerned about this, but I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so I've always wanted to.
So, but we can assume that around situations like this are feelings of guilt. Mm-hmm. Anybody else share? I know people have had this circumstance. Yes, would you share?
Yeah, with both my parents.
Yes?
Both my parents starved themselves to death.
They what?
They starved themselves
to death. Oh, wow.
It's not an easy thing to watch. Mm-hmm. But it was their wish. My father had a severe stroke. Couldn't speak. Couldn't move one side. and he had always told me that he would never live as a cripple. He was 84 years old, and he had been golfing and bowling both the day before, so he was an active man. And he had his stroke, and he lasted 6 weeks. We did everything to try to feed him, short of, I mean, it was encouraging, try to encourage him to eat. I even got a large hypodermic, and I would try to put food into his mouth, and he just would spit it out, and he, with a good hand, twisted it out of my hand. He made it very evident that he did not want it. So all I could do was make him comfortable for those 6 weeks. And after he died, my mother made the same choice. And she was a very healthy person. Within 6 months after his death, she attempted suicide, which we was rushed to the hospital and was brought around from that. And she told me after that, "Don't you ever do that to me again." She said, "I will not live without your father." And she proceeded to starve herself to death.
And what were your feelings throughout this?
My father died 5 years ago today. And you can see I haven't gotten over it yet. I'm an only child, so I had no other siblings to discuss this with. I just had the support of my husband and my two sons, and they were all very much aware of my parents' strong feelings. And it's something that you never get over, at least in my case, to watch my parents do this and do nothing. And at the time, I felt I was doing the right thing. Because at the time, I was doing their wishes. But once they were gone, I have yet to be able to live with permitting them to do it.
So you think, how do you think, Mary's the one, of course, that's spoken about preserving Tom's life at some effort and expense, and so what do you think is going through her mind at this point?
I don't know, because you go through such peaks and valleys. I don't think your mind is at one point, any one point. One moment you say, because they do, it was suffering I saw. The doctors told me that they were not in pain. But there is a suffering going on. And when you see that part of it, then you want it to be over quickly because you don't want the suffering to continue. And so while it's going on, I think I was much more rational than I have been since it's over, because I did not want to see the suffering part of it. And I wanted their wishes to be fulfilled. But once it's over, if you have nothing to live with but your own thoughts, your feelings are, at least my feelings, are so different.
Yeah, you feel you didn't do enough.
I still don't know if I did the right thing.
Right thing, yeah. Okay. Would anyone else like to share? I know this is a very tender kind of subject, and your own feelings. I appreciate that you shared much of your feelings, because I think one of the things that we really need to address when we get into euthanasia cases is that sometimes, you know, I can address this as an ethics case. And ethics, as I said, is primarily a rational activity, but there's so much that gets involved in terms of the emotions in this case, or cases when it's actually your situation. And increasingly, of course, in the world, and with the increases in technology, the advances in technology, we're able more and more to keep people alive. Euthanasia was not anywhere near the ethical problem many years ago when our parents were working, dealing with their parents. It was never anywhere near the same problem, but today, of course, we have our ways of dealing with that. Yes.
Well, I can share that both of my parents did have Alzheimer's and passed away 2 years ago. We had living wills for them, and I have no problem with that. But the problem I might suggest is that we had to be very legally correct and nearly have the paper stamped on them that these kinds of things were not to occur if they got into a hospital setting, because we were never sure who was going to be in the emergency room if they got somehow in there when they weren't supposed to.
Would you, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Would you explain, does everybody know what a living will is? Would you explain to everybody what a living will is?
Well, that they had signed a paper, and I need to mention this too, in the state of Oregon, it was only good for 5 years. We ran into a little problem. But that they come to a point where they are no longer functional, that they choose not to have any means, any extraordinary means applied. That's not food tubes, but extraordinary means, like the pneumonia. Mm-hmm. That not be done, no treatment be given, so that they're allowed to die passively. So if there had been a living will for your haven, for your young fellow here, then the family clearly had some indication as to which way to go. Correct?
Yes.
Yes.
In the state of Washington, does anyone know what the law is now? About 2 years ago, we passed a living will law, which...
But you need to be sure, just because you, or, you know, say this young man had by some reason signed this, or even indicated verbally, you still can run into some real legal loopholes if you get into some large hospital where you've got some right to life.
It has to be something in writing.
Well, yeah, or the family has to agree in writing, and then you've got to be sure it's nearly stapled to their chest bone, because right. You know, I mean, you know, that's
how many of you have living wills? Anybody here have a living will? Yeah, well, after they pass the law, you can get these living wills. I don't have my notes along. I have a copy. You can go down to my wife got it. At the stationery store, and then we had everybody in the family filled one out. And I, if you're interested, you know that those are available in a form, which now is it's legalese, but it's available. Yes, you had your hand up.
Going back to feelings, my father had an aneurysm and almost died, and then. And they went to extraordinary, but they did everything they could to bring him back as much as he could. And then, continuing 3 years, when as an active man he became sort of a semi-invalid, he had several more brushes with death, and I flew home from Omaha to Connecticut. And I felt that the things we're doing, I wanted them to do because not because he wanted them, in fact he had indicated that he was ready to go, but if I was not willing to let him go, I was not ready to let him go. And I later had guilt feelings for not being willing to let him go, and finally the doctor told him that the next aneurysm would be the end, and he said, oh good. And but it took some years for me to be ready to let him go.
Mm-hmm. Someone else had their hand
over
here.
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to have a husband who had a living will.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not have to make the decision. And it was a real blessing to me.
Well,
I didn't want to lose him, but...
I mean, you feel he had made the decision.
Yes.
And so you, and as a result, right. then the feelings of guilt weren't there.
Right.
You felt you were doing what he wanted.
Okay,
let's proceed with this case. I'm glad that you shared those because, again, I would think that these decisions are freighted with all kinds of feelings of guilt. And what is, let me turn to the family for a minute and let's just get at some of the problems they're having, the five of the family. One of my friends said that this case should be called not witnessing to life, but witnessing to death. What do you think they meant in terms of the case study that's before us.
On destroying family.
Yeah, there's more than one kind of death. The obvious thing is the young man, Tom, who is in trouble. But the other thing is that there's problems with the family, which are what? Would you describe them? Some of the things that are going on in that family situation?
Well, the whole family system changed when, because of this accident. The parents turned all of their resources, emotional, financial, and otherwise, to this comatose son, and the other two children obviously felt abandoned in the process, or something like that, and they had trouble coping with it, and they started using there was substance abuse involved with the family, mm-hmm. The parents, and
right, I forgot to mention,
yeah, and there was so, and it was all because their resources were exhausted.
Yeah, I think maybe something going on in the process of this 2.5 years, apparently, maybe a little less than 2.5 years. What happens when you've got a person like that? The thing is prolonged. There's no closure to the situation of death. Normally, there's a people have a disease or have a stroke or a heart attack, and death proceeds fairly quickly, some more or less, sometimes a little longer. But in this case, it's just extended, and there's no, it's a prolonged kind of thing. And of course, Mary's motive or reason for keeping him alive is what? Which is very understandable.
Hope for recovery.
Yeah, and there's a recent book out by, Reddick, it's called Maternal Thinking, where she makes a big point about maternal preservative love. And I think particularly strong that there is, in this case, it's a 20-year-old young man, not an older person, which is often the case in euthanasia, but that preservative love that's part of the child raising is obviously still at work, I think. What do you interpret from those of you who have read the case? What do you interpret John Haven's reaction to that? What was he going through? What were some of the things that were going through his head in this?
Well, by the time the child contracts pneumonia, the father sounded to me like he was ready to let go, that he was more aware, perhaps, than the mother of the devastation on the family that was still functioning.
What were some of the indications of that?
He said something like he felt like he was losing his wife. He said that to her.
Mm-hmm. And the kids.
And the kids.
And what did he said something about community?
He made the comment of how can you kill a person who's already dead? Uh-huh. When his brother or the uncle mentioned that you should not kill, thou shalt not kill. Well, how can you kill someone who's already
dead? Do you think that's an accurate statement to say he's not dead? What is, by the way, what?
That's the death. That gets in the definition of what death means.
What is death? You know, what is the official definition these days?
Brain dead.
And what's the indication in this case?
Some brain activity.
Yeah, he has minimal brain activity, so he's not officially dead. So in one sense, the father's statement is not correct, but what do you think he's saying?
When he's saying that we've lost the essence of who our son is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he's gone.
And so the essence, that essence is the most important thing. And once that essence is gone,
it will never come back.
It will never come back. And it's okay to let go. Mm-hmm. All right. Does anyone else want to say anything about the family situation or make any more comments on that?
Well, maybe this has already been said, but the SIBs, I think, seem to be have a combination of anger, resentment, and maybe depression that's alienating them and driving them away from the family and leading them to some substance abuse and so on.
Yeah, I've thought about this, and I don't know what's going through their head in this case. I'm sure it's all the attention is being directed and all the resources of the family are being directed to Tom, and they're probably feeling neglected. Do you think of anything else that may be going on there?
Well, people are being deprived of opportunities. You know, he's not being able to go to med school.
Pre-med in this case, yeah.
I have a slight problem with this, basically, kind of judging it on the basis of hindsight, as opposed to, okay, supposing we'd withdrawn Tom's food 5 years ago, or whatever it was.
2 years.
Now, can we guess what would have happened to Andrew and Grace? So how can we judge it on the present situation as to what we could or should have done in the past?
Well, we do know that as a result of that decision to keep him alive, that there has occurred these disintegrations. That we do know. I don't know what would have happened if they had presumably that it wouldn't have been as serious. I don't know.
Well, I don't think they can take the food tube away because that does incur pain. Because then that forces him to starve to death. But not treating the pneumonia does not incur pain.
Now, the definition of ordinary and extraordinary, of course, there's no scientific definition or medical definition. That's a pretty much a moral definition. And in some situations, the only one I know about that's spoken to this is the Roman Catholic Church. It says that sometimes even the food is an extraordinary thing. But normally food is ordinary.
But if you insert it in the emergency room, you're pretty well, you're left with that.
That, I see.
I think that.
I don't know.
Understanding.
Is anyone expert on that or in the group here?
What is the question?
Once you've inserted a food tube, can you remove it?
No. Not in California. You can't do without a court order.
Without a court order?
Right, yeah. And who wants to go through that?
Yeah. In some situations, that's why inserting that is a significant event.
Exactly. Yeah. But so I think Robert's question, that's not the issue. It's now they've hit an area of a decision.
So even if, you're telling me that even if they had decided to let him go, that they would have to leave the food tube in, right, and feed him?
Oh, but you mean with the pneumonia? Is that what
no, you're not saying? Even in the ensuing 2 years.
See, but you can't do that because he was in the emergency room. They had no idea, so they had to do everything then to try to clarify.
But when he goes to the nursing home, are you allowed to remove the food
no,
tube?
No, no.
Even with a living will?
Even with a living will.
Even with the living.
I don't know. I'm not.
Yes, even with the living.
Medical ethics is not my area, and I.
If the lady over there, if her conscience, you know, they were aware of what was going on, and they weren't in any pain with allowing them, you know, starving themselves to death. I don't understand how come an unconscious person would be in pain if they removed the sustenance. Is there something?
I don't know. It's not the pain issue, is it? It's the removal of the tube. I don't know. We're on a shaky area here, and I'm not sure of myself at this point, so I don't think I want to comment on the facts of that.
But you do have to look at that family dynamics, the living people that are left, the living people that have a chance for life, as opposed to focusing on the one. Mm-hmm.
That's added dimension to the case that you've got to factor into it, right? Ethical dimension. All right, let me look at what Dr. Karen Koh says. I want to look at these two characters because in some respects they introduce some of the main ethical elements into the case. What does the doctor say, Karen Cook, I keep wanting to say Koh, it's Cook. What does Karen Cook say in this case? Could someone read the important section there, that one paragraph of hers?
Dr. Karen Cook, their family doctor, discussed with them the possibility of halting nourishment. She stressed that because Tom showed no signs of life in the sense of being aware and interacting with human beings, it would be the humane thing to permit him to die peacefully. Christians, she insisted, do not consider the mere functioning of the body to be of ultimate significance, but rather the life of a person lived in community. She said she had come to the conclusion that feeding through tubes was a form of extraordinary medical treatment, merely a way of keeping a mindless body alive and therefore not morally required.
Now she's making she's using regular language and saying some very important religious or theological things. Would anyone care to try to attempt to state what she's saying in religious terms? What is she talking about here?
Separation of the body and the person.
Well, maybe, but I don't think so.
Well, she's saying that life is to be lived in community with others, and it's not meant to be lived in isolation.
Or out of communion with others. Okay.
And so when that occurs, why is that life?
And in a sense, what she's talking about is a term we often counter euthanasia is the quality of life. And she's trying to make her ethical case on the understanding that there is a certain quality to life which is dependent upon some sort of responsiveness in community, some sort of receiving and giving in with others, with God, insofar as we know. In the religious tradition, I think the main understanding comes from an understanding of the notion of God the Redeemer. The notion of redemption is to bring back into relationship. If sin separates in the tradition, then the notion of Jesus as the Redeemer, God as Redeemer, is to bring back. But that presupposes something to bring back, some sort of relational capability. Understanding here of sin and redemption in relational terms. And I think the basis of a Christian understanding is thus that God redeems, that when the possibility of redemption in so far as relationships here are concerned, that what the essence of life has been lost, and merely preserving the body is not so important, but what it is the redeemed body that's important. And the question of what happens in terms of life after death is left open in this kind of analysis, but there's an understanding that the quality of life in Christianity is determined by life in Christ, life in relationship to others and God, and that requires some sort of responsiveness. That's the one side of it. in the tradition. So a quality of life notion out of that religious tradition.
Yeah.
Is she also saying when she talks about mindless body that the soul is more important than the body?
I wouldn't read one thing into it or not. It's too cryptic here to tell exactly what she means. I think she's trying to get at a quality of life notion.
Who is to judge that you can't have a very spiritual relationship with God while unconscious?
That's why I always add the words, so far as we know.
Or the physical body God.
I don't know there's any way to determine that. You can help me on that. So far, I haven't been able to discover that.
But we are making that judgment.
I think we are. Well, at least we're leaving, suspending judgment on that. Not saying we know or not know. Yeah.
I've always wondered if the basic tenet of Christianity is that upon death, if we are to be saved, and not all are saved, we go and be with God and be with Christ in heaven. That's a pretty great place to be, we presume. And why are we taking such extraordinary means and inflicting so much pain on so many other people still active in their lives and spending so much money, which is another issue that we might address at some time, to keep this person apart from this bliss?
Well, why don't you answer that?
I don't see any reason to do it.
What?
I don't see any reason to do it.
Well, is there any reason to preserve life? Why don't we just commit suicide or murder?
At the age of 40.
First, my response is that not all Christians, of course, believe in life after death. That's been a majority opinion in the tradition, but there are different views in that among Christians. That's not a unanimous Christian view, of course.
Oh, I'd like to know more about that.
Yeah. I'm just saying that life after, if you're talking about life, heaven is a physical place that you go after you die. No, there's not any unanimous opinion on that.
But isn't in the non-academic settings, isn't that still fairly, most of the people who face this, that's where they're coming
Presumably,
from?
Presumably, yeah. It's not mentioned in this case.
What was
that? She's saying that popular theology...
The departments of religion have a different conception of heaven based on biblical themes than most of us who are in the other non-academic worlds as far as...
I would merely state it that there's differences of opinion among Christians. Not try to make a distinction between the academic world and the non-academic world, because I don't think those things hold. I mean, there really has been differences in the tradition over what happens after death. Christians don't believe in reincarnation generally, though I suspect you'll find a Christian someplace that does. That's what I'd say. That's not the main line of the tradition. The main line of the tradition has talked in terms of heaven and things like that, but there are differences of opinion. I don't know if I want to get into that at this point. I'm glad to discuss that with you privately. But that could get us off on an extraneous issue. Where was I? How did we get here? Oh yeah, the Redeemer, quality of life notion is the one side. I want to point out one other thing in this Karen Cook's position, and that's just an observation about how she is doing ethics. I want to make this observation because sometimes ethical debates or disputes are differences of how you read the Bible and how you do ethics. Very important differences. If you read the Bible literally or not, now I'm a Presbyterian, and right now in the church there's a big debate over sexuality reports. Some of you may have read this. debate isn't just over sexuality, let me tell you. It's debate is over how you interpret the Bible and how you do ethics. There's three debates going on, and there's considerable differences of opinion on that. Now, in Karen Cook's case, we have a style of ethics. She is rationalizing the case by saying there is an end or goal, which is the life in community. And that is what, there's no fixed way of determining what should do that. That could be any number of different acts, but the ethics is goal-oriented. And it's situational. What you should do to reach your goal is a situational judgment. Now, Uncle Bill Thompson has a distinctly different form of ethics. which is more rule-based. But I want to make that observation, because once you, when you're doing ethics, you should observe how people are doing it, and sometimes the conclusions they draw are diametrically opposed, not because of their sentimentalities, but because of the way that they are proceeding in their way of thinking. What does Uncle Bill say? Who would tell, read the salient parts of Uncle Bill's analysis? Someone has a case in their hand. Please.
John's Uncle Bill Thompson, who was visiting from Texas at the time and was present at the doctor's office, was aghast at the doctor's comment. His big frame stiffened as he quoted the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." He seemed ready to pound the table as he declared that terminating nourishment would be a form of killing. More calmly, he added that killing destroys relations in a community as much as it destroys individuals. Then he got up, ready to leave the office, and concluded, "God alone has the right to take life away because he is the one who authors it in the first place. She is the one who authors it in the first place."
Well, he said he in this case. This is a verbatim. What's the main gist of his argument? Exclude the statement about the end about God. I'll come back to that one about God is the one who takes life away. But what's the gist of his argument?
Well, at the end he says life is sacred.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Life is sacred.
Right. Once the pneumonia is discovered, Uncle Bill happens to call and they tell him of this dilemma, and then of course he's still on the life is sacred. Mm-hmm.
So life is sacred, and he buttresses that with a commandment.
We should do all in our power to preserve.
Mm-hmm. Because?
Well, he doesn't say it because. He says life is sacred.
Yeah, life is sacred, thou shalt not kill. There is basic guidance.
Right.
From the biblical material that tells us what to do. Notice the difference in ethics. It follows the rules or the guidelines. Mm-hmm. You don't want to talk about rules because it's too legalistic, but it has a definite set of guidelines or principles and he follows those. Karen Cook wants to say whatever produces the outcome or result of a redeemed life or a life in community is the way we should proceed. So there's a diametrically opposed kinds of ethics. Now, I would suggest just if God the Redeemer is the basis of Karen Cook's perspective, that the understanding in Christianity of God the Creator is at the basis of Uncle Bill's perspective. That is to say, there is a whole story of Genesis 1 that God created the creation good. That is to say, in this situation, that our bodies, our lives, are something to be good. The reason we don't commit suicide, whoever I was looking at back here, the reason we don't commit suicide and murder is because there is an understanding that the creation in our lives are good and life is worth preserving. And to be generous to Uncle Bill, I think that's the basis of his perspective.
I think you're being very generous.
I'm always generous.
Overly generous.
All right.
Very legalistic to me and not necessarily following guidelines that one could...
Well, the understandings of the sacredness in life and thou shalt not kill, what underpins that as a reason why we shouldn't kill, just apart from it's a commandment, is the notion that life is good. I must be generous to Uncle Bill.
I think the addition of the, I get your term, you use ordinary and extraordinary. I mean, the concept of the food too as something that's ordinary for Uncle Bill. Anything that exists, medical technology, mm-hmm. suddenly is in the area of ordinary, whereas for the doctor, the food tube was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a real split there in
That's
terms
right.
of how they view medical technology.
He would use all means possible to preserve the life of this young man, presumably.
Yeah.
He doesn't say that exactly.
It isn't part of our response to Uncle Bill that if we continue the sustenance and that type of thing, that we are thwarting God's decision to take that life.
Well, let's move into that question. This is in effect the thorny part of the case, I think, theologically. What does he say there? He says it's only God who can take life?
Yeah.
What do you make of that statement?
Not true. Patently false.
All right.
he has staked out one clear position.
Any of us has
the power to take anybody else's life, including our own, at any time.
But is God leading you to do that?
I didn't say that God is leading me. I'm just saying that we have the power to take life.
So you firmly believe that God does not take life, and that his statement is false?
That he says only God has the power to take life. He says only God.
Oh, I see. You're making a factual judgment about we can kill too.
That's right.
All right. Now, what is he saying underneath that, I think, though?
Well, I had my hand up before your question.
All right. Okay, I'll withdraw my question.
I guess my... just the whole issue of God, I think that there's the other theological issue there is that God gives life, and God does not give death, mm-hmm. and that death is an outcome, theologically, at least as I understand it, of the fall. And so it's not God's will that we die, it's God's will that we live. Mm-hmm. And so I think that maybe that's kind of what he's saying at least for me, the concept of, I mean, it's a concept of people say, well, it was God's will that Tom was in this accident. That Tom
people
died.
Will often say that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and I guess that I really struggle with that, because mm-hmm. to me it's God's will that he live, but that it was an accident that was due to circumstances and a situation that someone ran a stop sign is why he is in the situation.
Okay. I have another case that's somewhat similar to this, in which it's not a young man, but it's an elderly couple, and the husband has had a series of heart attacks, and he's pretty well gone. And the wife asked the son to pray for a miracle, because she's convinced that if they pray for a miracle, she's been watching certain TV evangelists, that if they pray for a miracle, that God will bring her husband back. The question that we're raising here, the very fundamental question about how God acts in the world, and indeed, it's a very important question in euthanasia cases. If you pray for a miracle, do you think God will come and relieve Tom of his symptoms?
Could. You could also relieve him of his symptoms by...
Do you think God acts that way sometimes? God doesn't act that way, but it could. She could act that way. But doesn't. Okay.
Maybe sometimes.
You said that?
That's the way I would see it. Yeah, maybe sometimes.
What's the problem, if I may inquire? What are the difficulties with that perspective?
What are the difficulties?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't empower us to pray and then God will do something.
Okay, but God doesn't just because we pray save Tom, but sometimes he does save Toms of the world, or she does. What's the problems with that position?
It doesn't fit into the scheme of beneficence.
Well, that's a very astute judgment. I will say that you're right, because at those moments when God acts that way, there is no human freedom,
yeah.
And ethics depends on human freedom. Yeah. So I'm out of a job. Seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's not human freedom, there's no ethics. If God, at least, and in this case, if God operates that way, ever, at that moment, that person that's being operated on, or the people in the situation, don't have human freedom. There's a more serious problem with that perspective.
The idea that if you pray hard enough, something will happen, and then if something doesn't happen, does that mean that I'm not holy in the eyes of God?
Well, that's another difficulty with perspective, is that if it doesn't happen, then you think, well, I haven't prayed correctly, or I don't have enough faith.
Or not enough people doing it.
They're not enough people doing it.
The whole idea that we can manipulate God.
Well, it's serious. The most serious, I think, problem with is it suggests that God's rather arbitrary. That does this one and does that one, and one has some questions about the lovingness of God, who would operate to, if we prayed right, say to bring Tom back. But we have 6 million Jews in the Holocaust who prayed pretty hard. Some of them, I suspect, but God doesn't operate in that situation. It raises very serious questions, and You may want to sacrifice the lovingness of God to reserve the power of God, but recognize that there, well, what I'm saying is to preserve the power that God will intervene like this. You may be willing to sacrifice a God who is always loving and responds to human need.
I guess what I meant was, I have to say, I wouldn't want to sit here and say there is no way that person will recover, because not even the doctors who are versed in this are saying there is no chance of recovery. There may be some slim chance of recovery, and I suppose they say that because once in a while, those people recover. I mean, is that why they say, there's a slim chance? Statistically, it's not very good, but...
They say the people that go to the, Lourdes in France, that pool where you're supposedly, they have about the same rate of cure as you get in the hospital.
Okay, so you're just saying it's pure whatever.
Well, I didn't say that. Actually, I'm seriously concerned about a God who will come in and arrest the laws of nature. Now, if he recovers, I can understand that as a natural phenomenon.
Okay.
But I'm a little bit worried about the God who does act like that. And I think what we have is models and pictures of God, and I think we've got to do the best. We can never find the perfect picture of God. Don't ever think that we ever get that. We never have God in our pocket. God's always free of us. But I think there are better and worse pictures. Yeah.
As I'm listening to all of this, I'm just wondering how this discussion may be different if this discussion were occurring in a community of atheists.
Well, we wouldn't be talking theology, I assume.
but I'm just kind of interested in what the complications of the decision-making, how they would differ.
Not much.
I don't think in terms of what you do.
Not family.
I think you would talk in terms of a quality of life and the goodness of life. Atheists talk about the goodness of life. They've got a problem about where that goodness comes from. But they often make that assumption. And so the dynamics of having on one hand the goodness of life, on the other hand the redeemed life or the quality of life. By the way, I forgot to mention in the quality of life notion is also notions of mercy and release from suffering, I think. That God, in God's redemptive act, part of that is to relieve suffering and to be merciful in terms of situations like this. Yeah. I have to sit down every once in a while because my back hurts. I'm not being impolite. Go ahead.
I was just thinking about the session I went to this morning about the miracles of Jesus. Do you believe that?
Oh, good. I've talked to Jeff about that and told him to set you up tonight. Yeah. What do you do with...
Mm-hmm. I'm getting really confused here.
Okay.
You question a God who could would heal this man, but we didn't question Jesus. He's going to raise Lazarus tomorrow, and he healed a blind man today.
Okay, this raises a very serious problem with the faith. And notice how we've got to go back to theology to do our ethics. I think that's a very important lesson, and I've staked out one position that I guess I have a problem with the miracle stories now.
So you don't believe in the book of John?
Yes, I do believe what John says. I just have a different understanding of miracle than the 20th century definition. Maybe Jeff would like to comment in a minute on this. That's a very serious point.
I think that's a good question about Christian versus atheist. And this kind of goes into the question we're talking about here. When we try and define God and how we understand things, we get into trouble. We can oftentimes make things worse than make things worse.
Well, except I think God gave us, my only response to that, God gave us intelligence to explore the world and explore God insofar as God has revealed himself to us, mm-hmm. And I think our responsibility is to try to push our thoughts as far as possible.
Yeah, I agree, but when we try and tie him down to the way we understand mm-hmm. things or our capabilities, I think we're running a wheel with something. Mm-hmm.
Also, we're picking this whole thing apart, and this whole family is disintegrating in front of our faces.
Well, that's the part of someone called case studies a kind of experience at half the cost. We can afford that luxury. So, and the reason I'm running you through this exercise is that most of us, a lot of us at least, will face this issue.
That's right.
And it seems to me that if we think this thing through with some degree and use our best minds to explore this issue, that we'll be better able to face it. And that will help both our sense of guilt and our emotions and our own sense of dealing with it at that point.
And look at the difference. It happens when you're dealing with it as a mm-hmm. as a personal issue and a family issue, and when it gets mm-hmm. involved in the community and the hospitals and Uncle mm-hmm. Bill and all that, it seems like it's the stories you're hearing is it's not easier, but it seems to be handled more humanely as a personal family issue than as a community issue.
Mm-hmm.
I recently heard about a case in, I think it was Minneapolis, of an elderly man with his wife who had been comatose for, I don't know, numbers of years. I don't remember the details, maybe 10 years. He insisted on her being continued to be cared for, in spite of the fact that the doctors say that she's brain dead and there is no hope. And he insists that this happen, and the hospital is full, and here she is. It seems to me that one of my concerns is that we'll ultimately make decisions based on economy rather than other things. You know?
Well, I hope we do as best we make it on our religious convictions,
but
not on the basis of economy.
It seems to me like the man is sort of idolizing when he's got this
the
sacredness of life business.
Yeah.
But,
okay, here and then here.
I want to support the comment
about, could we hear a little
about
louder?
The family. It seems to me the focus of our conversation has been wrong. But I think that the law will require that as long as there's some minimal brain wave there, that you're going to have to treat the patients.
I don't, you mean in terms of the pneumonia?
I think so.
I don't think the law
living
requires
well,
that.
20-year-old person,
I think it goes on all the time, by the way.
Beyond that, it seems to me that we ought to look at the family
yeah.
and whether society should force the family to exhaust their resources in themselves also in this case.
Well,
society
I think
shouldn't take over.
That's a very serious question, which is slightly beyond the scope of this case, which is the whole medical system in this country in terms of medical payment.
But if society were going to do it, it would ease the discussion of this case quite a bit.
I still think it would be a terrifically emotional problem about letting your son die. It wouldn't be in my case.
The woman in the back alludes to that Minneapolis case. That elderly gentleman did win his legal battle with the Minneapolis courts, and they continued life-saving techniques. The woman did die 3 days after he won his case. She was in her 80s.
She just died.
She died 3 days after he was awarded the right to continue. He had no money. The hospital and the state were paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep this woman alive. And of course, the ethicist said, where do we draw the line between keeping an 80-some-year-old person alive and we don't help Tom Haven, who's 20, which is, of course, another can of worms. And then an instance that I recall reading in the paper several months ago, a woman in the Midwest had a similar instance such as this. She had a young, I think it was a son, who had been severely injured, was in a coma for several months. I don't recall all the circumstances, but what she finally decided to do was, all of his organs were functioning. She said, I've had it. I want you to cease all normal functions, and the minute the brain stops, what little signal there is there, let's take everything out of him and give it to anybody we can. I want to find all the donors. I want to get everything lined up. I want the kidneys, the heart, the liver, the lungs, and the corneas. Everything was intact. They took it all out, and every piece of that boy went into another human being, and all those people are still alive.
Sort of life after death.
And that mother said, this way I can deal and look at these people and know that my son continued living in these other people and helped the quality of life of other people, whereas she felt her son had no quality of life. She had to deal with this.
Yeah.
And that's how she remedied it.
Mm-hmm. I want to get just back for a moment. I don't want to leave you. This is a confusing area. I would like to see if you have anything to say, Professor Staley, who's been talking about Bible study. But I think this is I don't want to get off this issue, but we stopped talking about your question.
What was the question again about?
The miracles of Jesus in the Gospel of John, which are signs. And does God cease to do miracles today? And the perspective that I was articulating suggests that there are real difficulties theologically with a God who acts miraculously in the sense of defying the laws of nature. I want to be clear about that. I think God I think the birth of a child is a miracle. And however, I don't believe that God intervenes to reverse natural processes. That's my personal
view. Why did Jesus choose that blind man and not?
Well, let me ask. How do we? Then the question is, how do we deal with the blind man?
Yeah, I mean, there's thousands of other blind people in Palestine. What does he? I would argue and believe that that Jesus was perceived and understood by his culture as a healer, as an exorcist. And certainly the Gospels bear that out, and that he and these stories are ways of describing a spirit that is in Jesus that can only be attributed to God. And I think John is one of the things that I like about John's miracle stories, we've been talking about them, focusing largely on them, is that in contrast to most of the synoptic gospels, in spite of the other unambiguous, seemingly unambiguous statements in John, those miracle stories are very ambiguous.
Yeah.
There is really a lot of questions. I don't think I'm reading everything into that. As to what is really going on in these particular stories in terms of sign, and that's true in the Synoptic Gospels. And Bob and I were talking yesterday. You know, the classic story: by whose power does Jesus cast out demons? Miracles are not unambiguous signs of God's activity in the world. There's hundreds of other miracle workers at the time of Jesus. So there's certainly, you know, a common pool there in one sense. You can look at the act of Jesus and say, which, you know, to put it in blunt terms, Jesus' opponents are saying, you know, the reason you can cast out demons because you're a bigger son of a bitch than the one you're casting out. How do you know that Jesus is casting out demons because he's got a bigger demon in him? I mean, in that sense. Or it's the activity of God, or is it, you know, in medical terms, are we dealing with deranged, you know, different kinds of psychoses and things like that? Different cultures have different ways of explaining things. I grew up, as many of you know, in Navajo Indian Reservation, and hey, there's spiritual power there that different cultures or different ways of viewing the world that we often. Perhaps are not, I think sometimes we're not aware of, and there are certainly aspects of in that world that they're not aware of other processes too, and how one finds balance. One thing, you know, that my mother died of a heart attack 4 years ago, we'll talk briefly about it, I think, tomorrow. She was on life support systems, you know, and there, I don't know exactly what went on, you know, the doctor came in and said, well, do you want us to keep trying, you know, to resuscitate her after so many continued heart attacks? And I'm sure they could have kept her hooked up and everything. And we simply said, we said no. At the same time, the night before she died, I had a long conversation with my father. And at the same time, from my perspective, you know, what do you do with the statements about asking? You know, and this is a big problem. You know, should Christians pray? I have no feeling no problem in a sense. I guess part of it, perhaps out of my own family upbringing, whatever, maybe not always theologically articulate, but saying, I think if we believe that God is good, we ought to ask God for good things to happen. And what that means in terms of whether, how we view God's activity in the world, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea. But I think, I believe that part of what my response is faith and living and trust in a God that that good means that I ought to ask for good things. And I think that's part of what these miracle stories are about, are getting at. You know, whether we can always argue there's a historical event behind everything, I certainly think that that world is.
Well, now we're into prayer.
But I didn't raise it, someone else.
The point is that how you pray depends upon how you see God acting, too. That's a very, very interesting further issue. Well, time's up. Sorry, but the final question that I was going to ask is, how is God at work in this case? Because if I've rejected a kind of miraculous understanding that God comes in and, I say, overturns the laws of nature, but I would not say that God is not present here. I think God is very much present in this.